Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season two on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season one and putting out daily recaps.
Beginning January 7th, we'll be dropping an episode featuring amazing special guests from the cast and crew.
After that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season two.
The Severance Podcast with Ben and Adam.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan, and joining us today is a longtime friend who's got a story to tell. Finally has a story to tell that he can share with a lot of people other than just me. We're talking to former undercover FBI agent and Dallas Cowboys Director of Corporate Security, Larry Wansley. Not only did Larry create the NFL's first player protection and support department, but he's also developed the blueprint for the TSA airport security all over the world that they started implementing after 9/11. Larry, how are you doing this morning?
I am absolutely terrific, my friend. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, let me tell you something. You and I have been knowing each other almost 50 years. That's how long this is how long we've been talking for all these years. And you would tell me little stories here and there, little things here and there. And of course, you know, your security, and I'm not going to say anything. I just listen, and you and I are friends, but I would just never say anything to anybody about it. And now you've got a book that's out, this book called Tough Streets, Rough Skies, and Sunday Sidelines. It was written with former Morning News reporter Carlton Stowers. And now everybody gets to hear about the amazing life you've led. Again, Larry, I'm reading the article in the Morning News David Moore wrote back around Christmas time, and my jaw dropped because some of these stories you've been telling me for years, they were like all painting the big picture of, wow, Larry, man, what a story. First of all, when did you decide? And by the way, they're going to have the rights to the movie has been out for a while there. But when did you decide, okay, time to get this book out or this version of the book out?
Well, actually, it was time. It was way overdue. And through a series of delays and COVID and all of that, it just sort of pushed things back a bit. But it got to a point where I needed to do something because I've been around a long time. I hope I'm around a lot longer, but it was time to get out there because there were a lot of stories that I needed to get out there and really give praise and thanks to a lot of people that helped me along the way that really, really did a great, great service and job to and for me.
It's an amazing story. And again, I was thinking about you all during the fall, because that's when a lot of famous athletes, including Patrick Mahomes, Travis Kelce, Dak Prescott, Luka Doncic, Tyler Seguin, Joe Burrow, their homes were being robbed or their cars were being robbed. And it was like there's this big thing, and the FBI was investigating, and there was hints that it might be some cartel or some group of hackers out of South America. And the first person I thought about was, I bet you Larry Wansley has an idea of what's going on. The reason I want to bring that up first is because I was thinking about you all this fall while these different things were going on, especially Joe Burrow, the quarterback for the Bengals. He was here in Dallas playing against the Cowboys. When he got back home to Cincinnati, he was robbed. And so it was like, wow, I wonder what Larry thinks about this and what he might be able to tell us.
Well, it really points to a problem that has existed for many, many, many years. The public knows the traveling schedule of professional athletes. That's information that's out there. The difference is now with technology, with the communications advantages that they have now, it is much more concise. It is much easier to facilitate movements and striking potential victims and everything else. The leagues do provide security services. And when I say security services, I'm talking about assessments of vulnerabilities of players' homes and that kind of thing. That is available. That has always been available. Now, some have not taken advantage of it or whatever. Some have. But it's always been there. It's done on a regular basis. But it's a voluntary thing. They have to ask for it, and then it is given. The issue recently is the fact that with technology, it is much easier for those folks, those criminals, to really move around and strike in very, very short periods of time. They gather intelligence just like our government does. So it's not a situation where it's helter-skelter, hit and miss. They really study. They really do a lot of research. And when that time is right, boy, they will hit. And I remember that day, Joe victimized us, but then when he returned home, obviously he had a big surprise. So it is a problem. It's facilitated by the technological advances. So consequently, we're very, very much aware of it. The FBI, law enforcement agencies, the communication and cooperation between obviously our industry and law enforcement is absolutely the best. But we've got a lot of work to do, and a lot of it starts with the victims or the potential victims themselves.
Yeah, and again, this is like everybody's like, wow, even the athletes, because, and again, some of those things you were talking about, people know their schedules and they've got security, but how are they able to get in and those kind of things? And I was thinking about you because, again, you created the NFL's first player protection and support department. And this was like 45 years ago. That's
Yes, sir.
that's when we first met way back in the 80s when I think it was, wasn't it Tex Schramm that hired you from the FBI, or maybe you retired from the FBI, and he said, you know what, we need somebody to take care of these players or help us help them keep themselves out of trouble. That's one way of putting it. And I want to know how you and Tex Schramm and Tom Landry came up with how you came about your job and how I think you were creating it on the fly. Am I wrong?
You're absolutely right. I was still with the FBI, enjoying life and everything else, and actually was on my way to Monterey language school to actually learn Arabic and Egyptian languages. And then the Cowboys opportunity came along. And again, the Lord puts you in places where He wants you. I was not even a Cowboys fan, now that's between us at the time. But I received a notice that the Cowboys were going to create a position. Tex Schramm wanted to talk with me. And I went to his home. I met him, had a delightful and absolutely enjoyable conversation with him for about an hour, during which he kept offering me drinks. And then after about an hour, Coach Landry showed up and we had a great time. We did not speak about anything that I thought was substantive from an FBI perspective. I showed up in a three-piece suit and, very, very straightforward and everything else. We didn't get into anything about my background or any qualifications or anything like that, nor did we get into the job, what the job consisted of. We basically had a couple of hours where we had a good time visiting with one another, and that was basically it. But Tex told me that he and Landry had an engagement later on, but he asked if he could give me a call about 7 o'clock at my home. I said, of course. And at 7 o'clock, he called me and he said, Larry, this is Tex. I sure would like to have you on my team. How about it? And I said, whoa, great. And that's about all they said. And then he said, well, okay, be at the office tomorrow morning, meet a guy named Joe Bailey. I don't care if it's 2 weeks you give the government or 6 months. It doesn't matter. You'll be on our payroll. And well, I've got to go give this speech. Click. And that was it. Well, it was a situation, quite frankly, that happened very, very quickly. And I thought that this was a monumental moment, but it terrified my family. It really did. I had a very comfortable lifestyle, even though it was very exotic with the FBI and undercover and all of that. But with the FBI, you knew what your life would be and what it is and what it would be for years. And so there was a great deal of uncertainty. on the part of my family that night. And that fear really transferred to me, like, oh, what have I just done? Until the next morning when I showed up and I met Joe Bailey, and then I learned what everything entailed, everything that I would get would be provided for me. But I asked him what my job description was, and he said, I don't know. You have to talk to Tex. Tex won't be back for about a week, so just go do what you need to do and get together with Tex. Well, Chris, there was a great deal of uncertainty, but the following week I met with Tex and I said, what's my job description? And he said, you government guys would be technical. He said, let's put it this way. When the players are on the field, they're Coach Landry's responsibility. As soon as they come off, they're yours. Your job is to make sure that when they go back on the field, they are 100% the best football player that they can possibly be. So any distractions in their lives or whatever, that's your job to take care of.
So you basically created the protocols, the security protocols. Basically, they said, okay, here's the clay. You make a statue, or you make the Mona Lisa, or you make the, I mean, I'm like blown away, because again, they trusted you to create a program that would keep the players safe.
Yes. One thing, and I'll comment, I'll clean it up a little bit, but as I left, Tech said, kid, I'm giving you a blank canvas. Paint me a masterpiece. Don't blank it up.
That sounds like Tex. Don't F it up.
So anyway, I walked out of there, and quite frankly, I had a lot of thoughts going through my mind and whatever. It was a turbulent time in the NFL and professional sports to begin with. But a couple of things that I initially did, I went to Cleveland. I met with Calvin Hill, Paul Warfield, Coach Sam Ritigliano, and a doctor named Greg Collins from the Cleveland Clinic. And they were just beginning to really look at substance abuse amongst players. And they were creating a group called the Inner Circle. And that involved players that had, had been impacted, that were dealing with their struggles. I was introduced to that. I then went to Hazelden, Minnesota, an inpatient substance abuse treatment program. They knew who I was, authorized me to be there, as did the patients with whom I had come to live with. My job was to learn. I came from law enforcement, where life was very simple. Drugs, narcotics, jail, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing in between. This is the solution. Well, now my life was going to be about helping people, doing something from a different direction. Consequently, I needed to learn from addicts, from people that were going through the struggles themselves, how they got there, how they were dealing with it. How do you get out of it? It was one of the greatest learning experiences, Chris, that I ever had in my life. And I have used that foundation. I used it subsequently for my first 6 years in the league. Every off season, I would go to a treatment center. I would find out what is their particular approach and everything else. I had benefit from a couple of former players, and I want to pay tribute to those guys. And it's noticed, I've given notice in my book also to them. But Thomas Hollywood Henderson and D.D. Lewis, former Cowboys players,
right?
They independently reached out to me and basically offered their experiences and their perspectives on what their lives had been, all to help me help their brother players. I will forever be indebted to those guys because they showed me a whole new world. They really did, from a player's perspective. And it really helped me a great deal in terms of formulating what I needed to do and go about. So those guys were absolutely phenomenal.
We're talking with Larry Wansley. He's the director of corporate security for the Dallas Cowboys. He has basically put the blueprint for security programs and player development and for all around the NFL. And I think what you're probably trying to say is Hollywood and Didi were showing you that when you're on a famous team like the Cowboys, America's team, and everybody wants to do something with you, even the drug dealers, even the people who want to party too much, and therefore sometimes players get into trouble, either they're failing the drug test or they get involved in over their head, and they were basically telling you this is a lifestyle just like Hollywood, just like, you know, New York or you know, the those who make the scene, and it's like, wow, and they're athletes, but they got a different line to toe. They have a different kind of accountability.
Oh, without question. Definitely. They were absolutely sensational. They were terrific. And they were caring. They cared about their brothers. They had that humanity aspect to what they wanted to contribute. And I cannot thank them enough.
So you talked about the program. Can you talk about a little bit more as far as at that time, was there random drug testing by the NFL? Because we knew they wanted the players to be as clean as possible, not fail drug tests, and not scandalize the league, and also take care of themselves and their health, and also be aware of people who may be using them to move other things and make themselves wealthy. Can you talk about those things a little bit?
It was a situation where there wasn't much that was taking place. It was more on the punitive side. It was not a situation where we really wanted to, when I say wanted to, that's not correct. But there was not a situation where there was a great deal of emphasis put on what gets a person to that point. Mm-hmm. The counseling, the understanding of it, the working with a person, it was in its embryonic stage at that particular point.
Oh, yeah. 45 years ago.
Yes, exactly. So it was all new, territory. And again, going back to Cleveland and Calvin Hill and Paul Warfield and those guys, that was like the cutting edge. They were beginning to realize that we've got to do something. And they started, and talking with Dr. Collins there at the Cleveland Clinic, they were just beginning to realize and focus on the fact that we've got to do something. And that's when I came along. And so I was learning from them, and from there, then I went to the treatment center, et cetera, et cetera. So it was developing on the fly. We knew that we had an incredible problem, wanted to do something about it. The league was committed to do it. And again, this was basically virgin territory for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about the security side of the things that you've learned with the NFL? Because, I mean, the FBI, there's things you learned and you did. Again, you had an undercover life at one point, which we will get into in just a little while here. But you also had to deal with, I guess, maybe there were people in the players' lives that were not good people that might want to, you know, use them and leverage that relationship, or even blackmail or things like that. And you'd have to have sit downs with different players or the coaches and say, guess what? There's somebody in so-and-so's life here and they're not a good person. And we've done the background check and, you know, they're going to do something that's going to be a bad look for everybody.
Yes, Chris, to put it simply, the players were being duped. They were being victimized. It was not an insidious situation on the part of the players.
Right.
These were guys that wanted to be the best athlete they possibly could. And they were surrounded by people that wanted to take advantage of them. And they did take advantage of them. By virtue of my FBI experience, there were some that I knew about already.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a situation where now I'm in a place where I can impact that. I can begin to educate them and tell them about the fact that you're being taken advantage of. You may think that this person really likes you, or, you know, because you get free meals or free this and everything mm-hmm. else, they're basically becoming your buddy, But they are doing that for a purpose, and that is to simply use you, use your information, your perspective as a professional athlete, a member of the team, and you're being duped. And a lot of them, several of them, couldn't really believe, oh, no, he's
that's my guy. He's good people.
Yep. So here comes this guy from the outside who's saying, hey, look, these people are using you and they're taking advantage of you and you're being duped and everything else. So it was a message that was, it was a minefield to kind of navigate, because you had relationships, people had relationships with others that they trusted and confided in and everything else. And then along comes Wansley, who said, hey, ain't so, you need to step back, need to let me help you through this, because you can have a lot of troubles because of this. So that was kind of the cornerstone of how it all got started. And it has been a growing entity ever since.
So let's talk about this. Other teams noticed that you were taking care with the Dallas Cowboys, the player development programs and the security, and they started replicating that around the league. Who were some of the first other teams that contacted you and said, what's the formula?
Well, there were other teams that Tex allowed me to consult, mm-hmm. quote unquote, with. There were situations where a coach would, and I won't identify the team.
Sure. Okay.
There were situations where a coach would call and say, hey, look, I've got a particular guy, player that needs some help. Can you do that? Would you do that? And Tex said, of course. Now, don't help them to the extent that they're going to beat us, but but no, from a humanitarian standpoint, no, do everything that you can to help them out. And as long as it's not taking away from what you're doing, you're needing to do with us. Well, it was all basically the same kind of issues and problems and everything else. Some players were guys that were really over the deep end and what have you. And but it was a situation where I did work with other teams on a consulting type advisory way. There were some that I actually brought into town, mm-hmm. and had those kind of interactions with and what have you. But it was kind of a situation, Chris, where it was, we're all in this together. That was Texas' perspective.
Yeah.
Help them out.
Right.
Because we have a problem. We've identified a problem. And if you can help others, go for it. Let's do it.
So when Jerry Jones bought the team, was the transition between Tex and Jerry the same for you? In other words, Jerry let you continue doing what you needed to do. Did he enhance it? Did he kind of change anything about it? Did he give you more tools to work with? I know that, you know, I'm going ahead and pull the curtain back a little bit. I know you, Larry. I know your son, Brian, and I know your daughter, Robin. Your wife, I just met her a couple of times. I don't really know her, but I know Brian is now doing a lot of the stuff that you're doing now, or you started. I mean, he's the guy that's the head of the players development program, where you're the corporate security guy. Could you talk about your relationship with Jerry and how it kind of changed how it stayed the same, or he just let you do your deal?
He was very, very supportive at first, Chris, when we had that transition, when the team was bought and everything else. There was a great deal of uncertainty because we just simply did not know. Mm-hmm. And there were people that were no longer with the organization and everything else. But Jerry had trust and confidence in me. And he, in fact, I gained more responsibilities under him and what mm-hmm. have you. So it was a situation where it was kind of business as usual in terms of what I do for the players and security and all of that. And then there were more operational areas. I ultimately became the operations director also later on. So consequently, no, there was support. He was extremely enthusiastic and excited about this new venture and everything else. And I was excited for him. I was excited to be a part of it. But going back to that initial situation where it changed hands, mm-hmm. We were all simply uncertain because we didn't know. And it's that way with any organization, any new ownership or whatever come in. And so consequently, you just don't know.
Before we go further into what's going on now, and before we get back into the days of your undercover work with the FBI, Larry Wansley, I got to hear your story, because I was there at this game in particular. The story about how Tom Landry got a death threat, and we were in L.A., Cowboys playing the Rams. It was a playoff game, I believe. And all I know is I'm sitting there in the press box, and the word came out in the second half that Coach Landry was wearing a bulletproof vest. Please tell us that story.
I'll try to give you the Cliff Notes version. It was something that was extremely unusual. I had never dealt with anything like that, but I received a notice that I needed to meet the NFL security rep and the Anaheim Police Department down in the locker room. And I went down to meet them. They explained to me that there had been a credible death threat against Coach Landry, and the shooter, the suspect was in the stadium. They had immediately launched a lot of undercover people and trying to get some people into the stands to check it out. They had credible information about who it was and what have you. And they said, okay, as they explained all that to me, they said, okay, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to go get my coach off the field. I went out, and that night, Eric Dickerson was running all over us that night.
Oh, yeah, 200-something yards.
It was ugly, and it got uglier with the death threat, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. But I stood beside Coach Landry, and I said, we have a death threat against you, Coach. I have to get you off the field right now. And he said, okay. He turned and he gave his clipboard to Danny White, and he said, I'm going with Larry. See you later. Let Jim Myers know. And then I had a contingent of law enforcement and security people, and we walked off the field, escorted him off the field, went to the locker room, explained the situation to him. And I said, Coach, you might want to consider calling the rest of the game from the coach's box. And he looked at me and he said, Larry, I have the greatest amount of confidence in you and all these professionals here. You know your business. I need to be with my players. I need to be with my men. We're being protected, alluding to, you know, his very, yeah, very firm and sound religious beliefs, standards. And he said, so I trust in you, and let's get on with it. But I really want to be back out on the field. There, Chris was an officer who was about the same size. And I basically asked him if we could borrow his ballistics vest. So they switched clothes. Coach Landry put the vest on, redressed. And of course, when we went back on the field, of course, this is Monday Night Football. Millions of people are watching, the commentators, Al Michaels. Everybody's wondering what's going on. Well, they did some before and after shots, and that's where they noticed the difference of this extra layer or this extra exposure of something that was not there in the first half, and concluded that, okay, this has to be a vest of some kind. The speculation had already been that there was a death threat, it was a dangerous situation, and so forth and so on. That's how it all came about. That's how it was handled. But it was obviously global news at the time, and it was just another first in the NFL.
It's absolutely amazing. And again, the courage of Tom Landry. I remember him telling me back in the day, he used to be a fighter pilot in World War II, got shot down. I was like,
he did.
So he's seen it all. I mean, it's like Tom Landry's Tom Landry. That's all we got to say. Oh, I got to tell this one. I got to hear this one. You got to tell us again. I remember way back when you took a leave of absence, and I said, hey, Larry, where you been? I haven't seen you in a while. And you said you were doing the security for Whitney Houston while she was touring Europe. And then all of us, and you told me the story, and then Years later, I see the movie The Bodyguard with Whitney Houston and Kevin Costner. I'm like, oh, wait a minute here. It's some similarities a little bit. not that you and Whitney Houston fell in love, but the fact that you were her bodyguard, basically, because you were director for security. How did that even happen? I mean, you took a leave of absence, text let you go, and then you came back. But, I mean, you toured Europe with Whitney Houston.
Well, first of all, let me qualify this by saying, when you talk about the movie and everything else, there's a significant difference between me and Kevin Costner.
Look nothing alike.
but also,
you look more like Denzel.
there was no romance or anything like that. She was more like a daughter. But yeah, ironically enough, from out of the blue, I received a call from her father, who said, up to that point, they'd been traveling the U.S. and everything was fine. Her security consisted of her friends, basically. And he said, now that we're going international, I need a pro. And I keep asking around and your name keeps coming up. So he called. He made me the offer. Really want you to do this. And I just very, very tactfully and gracefully declined. And I guess at that point, that was the first time that anybody had actually declined to come join them. And I said, I've got a great job. I really enjoy what I do. And through a series of phone calls, he kept calling back. And each time the numbers kept going up. And then finally he said, you're not playing football until the fall. So at least come talk to us. And he's
so it's a new year, 2025. And you're thinking, how am I going to make this year different? How am I going to build something for myself? But where do I start? Shopify is how you're going to make it happen, and here's how. Shopify makes it simple to create your brand, open for business, and get your first sale. The best time to start your new business is right now. Get your store up and running easily with thousands of customizable templates, no coding or design skills required. All you need to do is drag and drop. Their powerful social media tools let you connect all your channels and create shoppable posts and help you sell everywhere people scroll. What happens if you don't act now? Will you regret it? What if someone beats you to the idea? Don't kick yourself when you hear this again in a year because you didn't do anything now. With Shopify, your first sale is closer than you think. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to start selling with Shopify today. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
So we can work something out. And I told him, I will, let me go talk to my boss. And I went to Tex and I told him what was going on. And Tex, ever the visionary, said, wait a minute, let's think about this. The NFL is going to start an international league. And if I let you go do that, you have to promise me several things. First of all, that the operation here won't suffer at all. You can still, from afar, continue to do your job and take care of the Cowboys. He said, okay, no problem. I've got a great staff. We can do that. He said, secondly, that I can reach out and get you wherever you are. Yes, sir. And he said, the third point is that you promote the hell out of football because the league is going to start an international league. So if you can do that, you've got my permission to go do it, as long as you're back to run training camp. So off I went, and the rest is history. We did strike a deal. I struck a deal with John Houston and Nippy Whitney. Mm-hmm. And so off we went. And it was a really very interesting and challenging situation. She was great. My problems weren't really with her. Mm-hmm. It was sort of like the football business, it's the people around them.
Right.
You know, there were a lot of similarities about that because there were folks that were simply around that were trying to bridge again. So there were similarities there. But the interesting thing about it was at every hotel that we checked into along the way, I would have three or four boxes of Cowboys swag. And you know, the concert scene where, you know, stars are following one another, they're They're always in the audience. So mm-hmm. I would get all those
celebrities
praise. I'd get them tooted up in Cowboys gear.
Yeah, like jersey or something, T-shirts, yeah.
Right, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then there were a few times when Whitney would actually wear a Cowboys T-shirt doing a number, the show. You could not get better publicity.
Oh, Tex loved that. Jerry probably loved it, too, if he had owned the team at the time.
Absolutely. No, so we had that kind of relationship. And quite frankly, they thought, and I was the go-to guy for everything. And it was just simply a situation where they thought I would become so enamored with that life that I wouldn't go back to football. And I said, no, absolutely not. I promised Tex that I'm going back, and I will. And I recommended that they hire my advance man, who was a former Scotland Yard guy. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, with the contingency that you be kind of a consultant for us, you know. Mm-hmm. And they didn't. They wanted me, but they just said, hey, look, okay, if this is the guy that you recommend, well, we'll do that. But you need to be close at hand. And that's the way it went on from that particular point. But I kept that relationship going. I mean, periodically they would call about this or that and what have you. So it was always a good, solid relationship. Mm-hmm. But I really needed to get back to football because I thought the football world was crazy. No, had nothing to do, nothing on concerts at all.
Yeah, rock and roll and...
Especially internationally, traveling country to country, and every mm-hmm. country had its own rules, restrictions, and so forth, and cultures. So I was ready to get back to the sanity, quote unquote, of football, Chris.
Well, speaking of traveling around the world, you wound up at one point director of corporate security for American Airlines based here out of Dallas, American Eagle and Transworld Airlines, TWA.
Yes.
And during that time, you came up with the screening program for passengers in all of the U.S. airports. And again, this is kind of like the blueprint for TSA that we all deal with right now. Can you talk about that and about how you got the call to run up to New York when 9/11 happened?
Yes, sir. Prior to, and a lot of your listeners will identify with this because there was a time when you could go to the airport and you could go right up to the gate and meet your family member or whomever you were meeting, or you could go right up to the gate and see them off as they got on their plane. Well, the evolution of airport security was one where we ultimately wound up being responsible for the screening of passengers, and every airline contracted that work out to companies to do that.
Oh, okay.
Frankly, the performance was not that great. The FAA, which was the governing body and enforcement body, continually tested us. They were always trying to sneak threat items through, which they were successful at doing. And every one of those violations at American Airlines came to my department. And it was my staff's job to find out what happened, investigate it. But my decisions ultimately had to be, do we pay it? We just simply write them a check. Do we try to mitigate this thing? Do we get into a situation if we get into a legal action, if we try to defend it, cost us a lot more money in terms of legal fees? Or do we try to really get it down to there's a reasonable amount of money that we need to pay? And that's what it was. And at that time, Chris, it was $11,000 a pop. Ooh. I had analysts that did nothing but process those. And by the time it got to me, as I said, I had a decision to make. Well, I was in a conversation with my boss, the legendary Bob Crandall at American Airlines, one of the greatest teachers I've ever known in my life. And we were talking about a myriad of things, but it included the failures, the checkpoint failures and what have you. And he said, there's got to be a better way. And I said, yes, sir, there is. The bottom line to that was, you go study it with set aside some funds for you to do that. Go study it. Come back with a turnkey program that we can come up with a solution to this. So for all of 1996, that was my mission, of course, doing my regular job. But in January of 97, we had it, and he presented it to government and industry. It was well received. But the FBI, I keep saying FBI.
FAA, yeah.
FAA's position was, unless every air carrier is on board with this, we're simply going to wait and see what happens, et cetera. So from January 97 until after 9/11, I continued to try and push it, keep it on the front burner, and so forth. And then after 9/11 happened, and actually 2 days later, I received a call. Of course, I was in the American Command Center, and hairs on fire. Everybody was going nuts. Nothing was flying, and it was a turbulent time, as you well know. Anyway, I received a call to send the program back up to Washington, and 2 months later, with the establishment of the Transportation Security Act, it established the TSA, which consisted of the fundamentals of the program that I had submitted, or Bob Crandall had submitted in January of 1997. So, quite frankly, it was a bittersweet moment. Certainly, there was a great deal of pride in that what at American, my staff and I had been able to put together, but we were incensed about the fact that nearly 3,000 people died on 9/11.
Yeah.
That's the heartbreaking part of it, because that was deeply personal for me, up close and personal, and as personal as you could get under a situation like that if you weren't on the plane or in one of those buildings that went down.
Yes, it's absolutely amazing. And you were there helping out at Ground Zero. Months later, I got a chance to visit some of the people that were clearing out the things. And when I was with the Dallas Mavericks on a road trip, it was the first trip to New York in December, right after that 9/11 in 2001. And Donnie Nelson had a relationship with the city of New York, and where they wanted to see the players and kind of bring some levity to the workers there. And I'll never forget that as long as I live. So, and I wasn't even there, you know, when you were there. It was like days afterwards. It's still riveting. But again, it changed the way we do business in air flight. And again, we can't thank you enough for that part. Well, now notice, Larry, we haven't talked about your undercover FBI work yet. And by the way, we're talking with Larry Wansley. He is the director of corporate security with the Dallas Cowboys. He's got a book called Tough Streets, Rough Skies, and Sunday Sidelines that just came out. I want to touch on this briefly because it's so good. People should read about it in your book. But I do want to touch on it. I mean, you became an FBI agent and then you went undercover. And I'm curious about, okay, you were involved with freeing Patty Hearst, with the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. And then you were undercover in L.A. You had a pseudonym. Your family didn't even know you had a different life. You had a different name. And you were dealing with mobsters out in L.A., Las Vegas. This is a movie. And then you wind up in East Texas with a mob boss in East Texas that wanted to shoot you between the eyes. Larry, this is crazy stuff. But that was your life.
That was my life, but they didn't want to shoot me between the eyes. They shoot me in the head, in the back of the head. So,
yeah, I got you.
May have been a few inches, but it still would not have made any difference.
Woo. And so let's start right there. First of all, okay, let's go back to the Hollywood part briefly, because again, the book has it all. And David Moore wrote a brilliant article about it in the Morning News on Christmas Day. You can go to DallasNews.com and look up Larry Wansley, and it's right there. Just Google is your friend. But I just wanted to know, how long did you think you were going to do this double life undercover thing with your family kind of knowing but not knowing?
Well, Chris, actually, I came to Texas to get away from it.
Ah.
I did. The operation in California was hugely successful. And it was one of those things I went through. Let's put it this way. My family went through such an incredible, stressful time. I mean, the hardships that it placed upon them. I mean, I really felt so incredibly guilty about it. In that kind of work, for a crazy guy like me, there was sort of the thrill of the chase.
Yeah.
If you'll understand what I mean.
Yeah.
To get the bad guys, to out-con the con.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, my family was suffering incredibly. They really were. And it really, really hurt me because it was hurting them. So I came to Dallas to get back to normal FBI work. I was in Dallas one day before I was right back into it. But case was so incredibly captivating and intriguing that when my squad supervisor asked me to do it, I could not refuse because this was the ultimate challenge. And off to East Texas I went to basically take down a very, very corrupt organization out there consisting of government officials of varying types. And that turned out to be very, very successful.
I'm just glad you're still here. Again, it turned out to be successful because you're here to tell the story. But my goodness, all I can say is I can't wait till the movie comes out, if and when. And we have no idea who might play you, but I know it's going to be an amazing story to be told. And I can't thank you enough for sharing it with us today, right here on this show.
Well, thank you so much, my friend. It's been a joy. I was very fortunate nearly 50 years ago to meet you and everyone within this circle, within our environment and whatever. I have to give kudos to. It was welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationships over the years have been phenomenal. And as I said before, I'm blessed in many ways. I'm blessed because of my family, the support and the sacrifices they made for me, and the fact that I was able to work for some incredible, incredible men, Tex Schramm, Tom Landry, Jerry Jones, Bob Crandall at American Airlines. These are gentlemen that were all visionaries, and I learned so incredibly much from each of them that they have paid dividends for me throughout my life and some of my global travels and adventures. So I thank everybody for taking the time to listen to my humble story. And I thank you, my friend.
Oh, you know it. We got to get you on again real soon. And maybe we'll share some more of these stories that may still be in that book somewhere. He is, of course, my good friend, the great Larry Wansley, director of corporate security for your Dallas Cowboys. And his autobiography is Tough Streets, Rough Skies, and Sunday Sidelines. Larry, you take care of yourself, and I'll see you at the next game.
Thank you, my friend. Take care. Bye now.
Our next guest, Brandon Board, he's the executive director of the Tree of North Texas. Brandon's here to talk about the amazing work they do providing meals for children in North Tarrant County and more. Brandon, how you been?
Man, things are great. Weather's finally starting to warm up, so, we are staying busy.
I know you are, and the school semester started up again for the second. It's the beginning of a new school semester, even though the year continues. It's already 2025. I want to know how the numbers for you guys have been looking since calendar 2024, because so many things were happening and you guys were taking care of so many kids and so many different activities. And I was like, wow, you guys seem like you're on the upside right now.
Yes, sir. And one of the things about our world is when our numbers and our workload is heavy, it's kind of a downside because there's a stronger need for us. And we're not 100% done with 2024, our final numbers and things like that. But of the four school districts that we support, which are Keller, Birdville, Fort Worth, and a little bit of Northwest ISD, we were able to finalize our numbers yesterday for just Birdville ISD, which is, it's got five or six different cities in it.
Mm-hmm.
In 2024, our final numbers are 456,421 services.
Wow.
Just for that one school district.
Wow. That is absolutely amazing. Talk about affecting lives and changing things. Man, you guys are making a big impact. Can you talk again about some of the things that you actually do for the kids in the school district?
So we basically have 3 to 4 main programs. And what those are, the first one is our snack pack program, which is, it's for the students that over the weekend that are away from their free and reduced meals on campus, we want to make sure they've got something to eat when they're not home. So what we do is we build 5 on your normal 2-day weekend. It changes a little bit with longer weekends and holidays, but our normal 2-day weekend, we supply 5 snack items for each student. And why, everybody always asks why 5. And the meaning behind it is it's so that the students have something to eat Friday night when they're at home. Then you have 2 items on Saturday, 2 items on Sunday, which then they wake up Monday morning and they should get their free on-campus meals, at least for breakfast and lunch those days. And with those across the districts that we have, we actually send out about 17,000 of those every 2 weeks. And so when you do those numbers, it's 17,000. Well, it's actually times 5 because every free pack has 5 snacks in it. So you can imagine just in a 3 or 4 month period, you know, those numbers become astronomical.
Just amazing. And so as it was growing and as the need was getting larger, who were you turning to?
So we partner with a lot of different folks. I know that you and I get a chance to talk every so often. That purple and white stadium downtown Fort Worth, you know, Mr. Carter.
Oh, yeah.
We partner with the Amy Carter Foundation.
The Carter. That would be TCU Stadium.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. We have a really, really good partnership with with Classic Chevrolet there in Grapevine. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got dealerships all over the place. We also partner with the Tom and Susan Durant Foundation, along with we've got some box stores that we partner with. And then, of course, your everyday donor who comes through our front door that may have a box of snacks, may have, you know, a $20 donation. A lot of people don't realize, because we have folks that talk to us from time to time, that I can't really support a whole lot. Anything, any size donation is amazing. I've got one donor that really wants to be a part of us, but they can only afford $5 a month. Well, that $5 a month, Chris, helps supply 17 to 19 students a month just with $5. So you have a lot of folks that, you know, they may not be able to write me $1 million check, but do they have time to volunteer their time? That saves us money, which in turn is, you know, because we don't have to pay somebody. So there's all kinds of ways to support not just the tree, but any organization out there.
What do they say? Time, talent, or treasure? We appreciate any of the three. And again, the Tree of North Texas, you guys are getting things done. I want to ask you again, how'd you come up with the name the Tree of North Texas?
Actually, a few years ago, I was with a couple of people and we were kind of brainstorming. And it was one of those things that I'm a firm believer that when God's got something for you, it just clicks. And I was literally standing there staring at a tree in front of Birdville High School, which if you go on our website, you'll see it, because there's a different, it's just that perfect, I call it a Simpson tree. Like if you see the Simpsons, it's like perfect. And all of a sudden I was like, it just clicked. And then, we came up with TREE as an acronym. So TREE stands for teaching, reaching, educating, and empowering.
Boom.
Which is all the things that we do. So it just fit.
Yeah, it does fit. I like that. I like that a lot. Talking to Brandon Boyd, you had also mentioned there's 2 other things that you guys do. You mentioned the snack program, but there was 2 more you were going to say.
So one of our big programs is our hang program, and we are in the midst of we're revamping it because we got some new information as to how it could better support the students. So what the HANG program is it stands for helping anyone needing guidance. And we focus on the middle school level. And what we do in that program is we literally send volunteers to hang out with middle school students, because Chris, I don't know if you know this, but middle schoolers are the smartest, coolest, most important people on the planet. When you're talking to them, they don't always have somebody to talk to.
Yep. You know what? And they know this.
and they know everything.
They know everything.
If we just listened, if we just listen to seventh graders, man, we could solve all the world's problems in like 5 minutes.
They're amazing. They're amazing. But there's a way you have to talk to them, right? Because they know everything. So there's a certain way you have to talk to them to get something in, right? To get some knowledge.
Yes, sir. So we send out volunteers of all different ages. A minimum, they have to be, because we have some seniors in high school that will come. So you have to have 4 grade levels between the student and the volunteer. So if you're a senior in high school, you can work with the seventh grader. And what we do is we have volunteers from all different organizations, companies that they will come out and you literally sit at a table and you kind of pick their brain, because a lot of people don't realize that these students may not be a one parent household, but mom and dad may be working late hours or
they're kind of raising themselves.
Right. So a lot of the time you'll have older brother comes home and takes care of younger sister. So they don't necessarily get that one-on-one time with mom or dad or whoever they live with. So this program is, we put one, our goal is one volunteer to one student. You sit across the table and you just kind of hang out with them, talk to them, see what's going on. If they need some homework help, we do that. If they've backslid a little bit, so they need some tutoring, we help try to get them caught up and things like that. But you see the light in their eyes start to take off, because somebody that doesn't know me is taking the time to spend with me alone, no outside world, no cell phones, no, screen time, anything like that. And these kids, sometimes they open right up. Sometimes it takes a little bit of encouragement, but they come in, they have a snack together. They, kind of talk about things, whether it's the Mavericks or the Cowboys or, what band is coming to town that they're excited about, things like that. So you never know what the conversation might be, but these conversations are legitimately awesome for the students.
It's very awesome for them because, again, it's in person. It's not just social media. It's not just watching something on their tablet or watching something on the TV later on at night and no real interaction. This is person to person, and that's kind of one of the missing pieces nowadays. I think we took that for granted back in the day, but nowadays kids to have personal interactions with people, that's actually stronger than ever before.
100%. And you don't realize how important things like writing a letter, a thank you letter, handwritten is, because they don't think about that.
Yeah.
So whenever they start getting these letters, because we have some people that want to support them but can't necessarily come to the time frame, so they'll write them letters.
Oh, it means
a lot.
So
you watch that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because it's not typed up, it's literally on a piece of scratch paper and it is handwritten. So, it's always fun to do some of the older things where today's generation, they're still intrigued and excited about.
Exactly. So what's some of the big things coming up in 2025 for the Tree of North Texas?
So we are right now, we're actually partnering with Classic Chevrolet. They are doing a really cool program for us. It's called Restock the Pantry. We are one of 3 organizations, because what a lot of people do, and it's not a negative thing, it's just kind of the way the world is toward the end of the year, everybody with the holidays wants, comes out and helps and supports. Well, what we end up doing is we burn through our back stock of snacks and thing, in our nutritional center and stuff like that. So Classic Chevrolet has stepped up and they're doing, it's called Restock the Pantry. And it's at any of their dealerships, you can drop things off. And it's literally with a name. It's to help us catch back up, because the first quarter of the year every year is really hard on most nonprofits, especially us, because we're smaller financially, because we have to catch up from everything, that we did over the Christmas break. So that's one thing. In September, we have our golf tournament that we're just about to go public, because I've almost signed the dotted line. It'll be our 3rd one. I know I send you some information all the time, so we will pump that out throughout our websites and stuff like that. But our next big program that we're preparing for will be our 3rd full summer, because we were founded September 1st of 22, that we are working hand in hand with Birdville ISD to have a summer education program. And what that's looking like is it's going to be 1 to 2 days a week for a four week session. And then we will take a break around the 4th of July. And then it'll be another 4 week session middle of July until just before school starts. So I just, ask people to keep an eye out for that. That's a great way for volunteer hours for your high school kids that need things like for green cord or special school events. It's a lot of fun. We're excited because this will be our first year to kick it off. We did one last year. It was just much shorter. So we're excited about that. And then it's crazy, but over the summer, our needs skyrocket because kids are out of school with their free and reduced meals. So we're already preparing for spring break, which is in about 5 weeks. And then we're going to prepare for summer because we will have, last year we had 86,000 requests for snack items over the summer. And I expect that this year our numbers are going to be somewhere about 107,000. And our goal is a minimum of one item per student per day. But our goal is to actually get them three. It's just based on the quantity that we get. So you can see those numbers. Those are some big numbers for just about 9 weeks worth of the year.
Yes, sir. And I want to thank you again for joining us, Brandon. And thank you all for joining us on Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold. So long, everybody.